Excision number 13075, reel 2.
So I had a number of incidents and accidents. One in particular, I had been doing a quite interesting trip in the Hawker P-1052, which was a swept wing forerunner of the Hunter. And it was not uncommon to have to scrape a hole in the hoar frost on the inside of the windscreen because there were no provision for heating the windscreens. And so one carried a glycol-soaked rag and a wooden chisel. And coming in on short finals over Farnborough Town, I was scratching a hole in the windscreen, hoar frost, to see to land, and the engine stopped. Habit caused me to call the tower and say, engine failure, crashing. To which they replied, say again? Crashing. Roger. I know there was nothing they could do to help, but it took me a long time to forgive that laconic, long-drawn-out Roger. And I was incredibly lucky. I just missed the roof of the Swan Hotel, just outside the entrance to the RAE, and plunged into the roof of the bicycle sheds by the main gate, which in those days were fortunately made of wood and corrugated iron. And I came to rest totally unscathed.
You must have hit them doing what? About 150 knots?
Probably 110.
But they slowed you down adequately?
Yes, progressive slowdown, rather than the impact I might have had if I'd hit the stone built.
You didn't have low-level ejection seats in those days, did you?
No. And in any case, of course, I was in the middle of Farnborough Town, so I couldn't have very well ejected. Yes.
What were the strangest aircraft you flew that fascinated you?
Well, you know, I think later on I found the same thing in industry. What fascinates the test pilot most of all, I suppose, are in some ways the worst features about an aircraft. Because once an airplane has been developed to meet all the requirements, roughly speaking, one aircraft is very much like another of the same class. But when things are unusual, that can be quite interesting.
Can you give me an example?
The Hawker P-1052 had some fairly dramatic characteristics at high Mach number, like a succession of nose up followed by nose down trim changes, and recovery from a steepish dive was not all that easy because we hadn't yet moved on to moving tailplanes or VI tailplanes. Elevators tended not to be very effective. And so one would need to pull fairly hard from, a 40-degree dive around about 9.3, 9.4. And at the same time, one would be combating, as I say, a series of strong nose-up or nose-down trim changes, wing-dropping.
Of course, you had the tail of the 1040 on, the old
single
tail, didn't you?
Yes, the straight tailplane.
Was this just a step-by-step in the exploration of sweepback effects? They only swept the wings back?
Oh, yes. They all varied, you see. The Supermarine 510, which was the forerunner of the Swift, that would have directional trim changes as a limiting Mach number. Most aircraft at that time had suffered from wing dropping, which could be quite frantic. Buffeting was commonplace.
It was essentially problems of transonic flight. I mean, when you're talking about high Mach numbers, you're talking about speeds approaching that of sound.
That's right.
And where you get compression, waves of compressed air, on the control surfaces of the aircraft and doing unconventional things, unexpected things to it.
That's right. And, you know, whilst nowadays supersonic flight is nothing very dramatic, in those days the difference between being in control and out of control could be as little as 0.005 of Mach number. So at 9.4 you might just be okay, and at 9.45 you're in some trouble.
You mentioned the DH-108, you flew that as well, didn't you?
Yes, but not very much, because soon after I joined Aeroflight, there were two tragic accidents in the other two 108s. The squadron commander in Aeroflight, when I first joined, was Stuart Muller-Rowland, and he was regrettably killed in the high-speed version. Jumbo Genders then came back into Aeroflight from elsewhere, and incredibly, unfortunately, he lost his life in the low-speed version.
Were that both accidents due to longitudinal instability because of the lack of a tail and the short fuselage? I mean, were you
no.
aware of this when you flew it?
Well, yes, of course. I think in the case of Stuart Muller-Rowland's accident, it was a systems failure rather than anything to do with the aerodynamics of the aircraft. And in the case of Jumbo Genders, it was a stall which led to a spin, and it's a long time ago, but I think I'm right in recalling that he operated the anti-spin chutes and only the pro-spin chute came out on the wingtip. And there was no ejection seat, and he bailed out, and very incredibly unlucky, the pitot head on the wingtip passed through his parachute harness, and so he was pinioned to the wing when it crashed.
What was your experience of flying these two aircraft? I mean, particularly the high-speed one, that seemed to have a very cramped cockpit. It had no paint.
I'm sorry, which aeroplane are we talking about?
The third one, the high-speed one.
Ah, yes, I didn't fly that one because they were both, that was lost.
Yeah.
So I only flew the low-speed version on one occasion only. Yeah. So I couldn't
that
really...
That was essentially a vampire fuselage, wasn't it?
Yes,
Because when I talked to Jaeger, he flew the X-4, which was the equivalent.
Yes.
But it had speed brakes that could pull it back out of trouble.
Yes.
Quickly, and it was had more power to it, I believe.
But yes.
He discussed that along with me.
Yes.
What about the AW-52, that straight flying wing? Did you enjoy that?
Oh, yes. One of the firm's test pilots, who later flew with me in industry, used to refer to it as looking like a ruler, and certainly flew like one. That's to say, heavy as a Lincoln on the ailerons, and touches a Spitfire on the elevators.
Have any interesting moments in it?
No.
But that was the first life-saving ejection took place on that one, didn't
That's
it?
Right. So that was...
Joe Lancaster who did that.
That's quite right, Joe Lancaster, yes. And so by the time the remaining one came to Farnborough, there were some pretty severe limitations, which I cannot remember offhand, but they were probably something like 0.5 in Mach number. And 300 knots, or 350 knots, in speed.
You see, it's interesting now to compare that machine with the American B-2 that has complete computer control.
Yes.
So that you don't make any mistakes.
That's right.
You know, you do not make extravagant pitch movements.
Yes.
And you've got power control on the
Yes, elements. Yes. Yes, you see, power control is an artificial field, made a tremendous difference to most aircraft, because none of the horrors of manual controls and all their shortcomings at a high Mach number were manifested once you'd made them fully power operated. Like, for example, we were able to borrow an F-86 from the Americans. And even more particularly, that was the A5 version, even more particularly, I was able to encourage Farnborough to allow us to get our hands on an F-86E, which had the flying tail, at a time when we were struggling in this country with longitudinal problems that I touched upon a moment ago.
So the E was the first flying tail?
It was.
Ah.
Yes. And so whereas on the A5, although folklore had it that the F-86 was supersonic in a shallow dive before breakfast, this was absolute rubbish. It was necessary to climb to about 42,000 feet and dive at about 50, 60 degrees, and eventually, at an indicated Mach number of 1.15, the bang appeared on the ground. But recovering from that dive, the elevator wasn't much use and tended to shed rivets from the trailing edge. But fortunately, even the A5 had a variable incidence tailplane, and so one recovered by thumbing back on a switch on the stick to change the incidence of the tailplane. Whereas on the F-86E, tailplane and elevator were connected together and to the stick and made for a very effective pitching control at high Mach number.
The elevator acted as a spring tap for the whole...
if you like, yes.
It worked that way.
Yes, yes.
So the main tailplane was not powered by the stick, was it?
Oh, yes.
On the
E? Oh, yes. Yes.
Because normally when you have a spring tab, the tab is powered and the aerodynamic forces on the tab move the dog that it's attached to.
No, the whole tailplane elevator combination was fully power operated on the E, whereas it was simply electrically operated on the A5, the tailplane. And so, you know, I was referring to the need for a steep dive. In a dive which was not steep enough, one would get stuck in a strong wing drop.
Now, power controls then first appeared in this country on the Bolton Pool, did they? On the 120?
Irreversible power-operated controls, I suppose, were first on the Bolton Pool P111, the one without the tailplane. And unfortunately, they had very, very poor feel. In the elevator sense, there was no allowance for increasing speed. And so as the aeroplane went faster and faster, the stick force per G became minuscule, so it became a rather touchy fore and aft control.
You could break the tail off quite easily.
If there had been a tail.
Yeah, yeah. So if we could continue talking about the Bolton Pool 111 and your experience on it.
Yes. Well, the BP-111 was flown on its maiden flight by the then squadron leader Bob Smythe, who was the CO of the aerodynamics flight in which I was serving. And he was shortly joined in the program by the late Lieutenant Jock Elliott. And I think I'm right in saying that they shared the flying at the 1951 SBAC show at Farnborough. And I took over in the following month. It was an interesting aeroplane in many ways. was the first, I think I'm right in saying, with fully powered controls with artificial feel. The artificial feel was not... was fairly primitive, to say the least, and so it made for a somewhat touchy aeroplane. And I only made 8 flights in it, and the undercarriage, which had given us constant trouble, eventually failed to work at all, and I had to do a belly landing in it at Boscombe Down. And of course, without the benefit of it didn't have any air brakes or flaps, and without the benefit of undercarriage or wheel brakes, it certainly slid for an amazing distance along the runway at Boscombe. And after that, it was 18 months before it flew again, after modifications and repairs. And by that time, I had moved on away from Farnborough.
Did you, I suppose, the Sea Vixen, the DH110, arrived on the scene after you'd left Farnborough?
Whether it was, I suppose it must have been. Yes, yes, certainly the 110 was not there when I was there. You're quite
never
right.
Flew it anyway?
No, I didn't.
That had
no,
power controls,
no.
Didn't it?
Yes, I think so.
A terrible accident was caused by a power control problem, wasn't it?
John Deary's accident at Farnborough. I'm not sure if that was the cause or whether it was a structural failure. Mm. It was, in fact, a structural failure.
Yeah.
But what that was attributed
to...
heavier
manoeuvre loading.
Yes, yes,
anyway,
yes.
You left Farnborough and went civil.
Well, in fact, whereas a lot of people, after 3 years at Farnborough, looked around industry for a civil test flying job. I, having been in the Royal Air Force since 1935, I elected to go to Staff College at Bracknell. But halfway through the year's course, I got a message that Sir Roy Dobson wanted to see me. And eventually we got together and he invited me to come to work at Avro's, because I had flown the Avro 707s, both the low-speed version in Aeroflight at Farnborough and up at Woodford on the high-speed version, the A, which had fully powered operated controls. However, both Dobby and I agreed it would make sense to finish the course. It didn't really, because for the next 6 months I was doing my own personal appreciation, stay in the Royal Air Force or leave, rather than the set exercises. But eventually I took the decision and joined Avro's in January 1954. Yes, that's right, yes.
How did you, what were your memories of Sir Roy Dobson? Because he was a major figure in the aircraft.
Oh, he was.
Can you tell me a bit about him?
Oh, he was a marvellous chap to work for in many, many ways. Perhaps he was probably a little bit on the mean side, and after I had been there a few years, I had to raise the terrible subject of salary with him. And he said, whilst my memory nowadays is not what it was, I go upstairs to get something, get up there and can't remember what it was. I have perfect recall for dialogue from 20, 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I'll always remember Dobby's reply. Oh, bloody hell, Jimmy. I bet you took more out of the company last year than I did. You know, he said, I only took 500 quid out of the company last year. And I said, well, Sir Roy, if I had a nice flat in London and a nice house in the country and cars at both ends and free food and wine, I would only want £500. To which Dobby replied, you cheeky young booger. Morale, of course, in those days, in the early days of Vulcan, was absolutely sky high, and money didn't seem to be awfully important.
Now, Stuart Davis designed the Vulcan, didn't he? Was he chief designer on it?
Yes, he was. Cock Davis, as he was known as. Mm-hmm. Yes, he was another great character in the industry, or is.
And Rowley Falk was chief test pilot then?
Rowley had a rather strange position because Jimmy Orrell had the title of chief test pilot but did little or nothing on the Vulcan. He did fly it once. Rowley was recruited after Red Essler was killed in the 707.
The first one, yeah.
And after... And I don't wish to diminish Rowley's contribution, by no means, because clearly it was Rowley who put the Delta shape on the map in this country with his wonderful demonstrations in the 707 and later the Vulcan. But having said that, he was perhaps, if it doesn't sound too cruel, a better demonstration pilot than he was development pilot.
He had a lot of panache, both as a pilot and as an individual, I believe. Didn't
he had. Oh, yes. Absolutely. Absolutely.
I've only seen pictures of him, and he looks very debonair. And
oh, yes, yes, yes. I recall one occasion at Farnborough when he was going to fly the then Prime Minister, and it was, one could clearly see somewhat of a sartorial battle as to who was the better dressed between Anthony Eden and Rowley Falk.
He was going to fly him in the Vulcan, or?
Yes.
Perhaps, you know, we can start on the Vulcan story. We've referred to the 707. I think perhaps you could give me a rundown. This is a very well-known number. It is not to be confused with the civil airliner.
Right.
These were the small-scale versions of the Vulcan, and four.
The one that crashed, and then came the 707B, which had manual controls, and then there was the 707A, two 707As, and the 707C, which was a side-by-side two-seater. They all had the Derwent engine, which was not really strong enough, and didn't have a lot of fuel, so that a typical test-flying development sortie would be 25 minutes of climb to 35,000, 40,000. Five, if the weather was good, 10 minutes hard work, and then back to land.
The B version was the slow speed investigation.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Yes.
Now, there was an awful lot to investigate, because this Delta form was a very new form, although it had been invented some years before.
Yes.
In Germany.
Yes.
But I don't think there were any German Delta aircraft flown, were there, that I can think of?
I cannot think of any offhand, no.
There was a
I think you're right, none.
163, which was tailless, rather
right.
than 108. But
right.
Now, presumably, therefore, you had a lot of fundamental aerodynamics to learn on that.
Yes.
All over the spectrum.
Yes.
All over the flight envelope.
Absolutely.
Can you tell me of your first experiences in encountering the Delta, and what surprises it had for you?
A lot of the shortcomings of the 707B were due to the manual flying controls, and at low speed some of the imperfections were quite unpleasant in the way of stick force reversals due to the aerodynamic balance on the controls, as well as the fundamental planform of the Delta shape. So that slowing down towards the stall, there would be a stick force reversal, and whereas normally it's necessary to pull further and further back and harder pull force to slow down, this would be reversed on the 707B so that a reduction of 10 knots would require a push rather than a pull. At the stall itself, which would be preceded by wing rocking rather than wing dropping, as alternate port and starboard tips stalled, there would be this wing rocking manifestation. And at the stall itself, there might be quite a fierce wing drop, and in fact, it might then spin. It only ever caught me out on one occasion when it spun, and I quickly streamed, or thought I streamed, the anti-spin chute and took normal spin recovery action. And when it had recovered in a dive, I was surprised to find no particular drag from the anti-spin chute. It was only after I landed that I discovered that there had been a malfunction and the anti-spin chute hadn't worked anyway. The power-operated flying controls, of course, got rid of these so-called stick-free effects, and so as long as the aeroplane was inherently stable, it didn't come through as stick force reversal. At the high speed end, well, throughout the middle speed ranges, the aeroplane would be fairly indistinguishable from any other aircraft. Approaching the high Mach numbers, the first manifestation would be an increasing tendency towards short period pitching oscillations. When I say short period, I mean something like one or two cycles per second, far beyond the capability of the pilot to control them. And so clearly this was a potentially hazardous situation. And in fact, the Vulcan finished up on the Mark II version with quadruplicated pitch dampers, one working on each elevon surface. And so it would be made for some quite interesting development flying to get all of the gearings in the pitch dampers to be correct for the ever-changing periodicity of this short period oscillation. And so when the aircraft entered service, hopefully this would be a completely unknown as far as the service pilot was concerned. The quadruplication on the pitch dampers had a comparator system so that there would be a majority vote. And so if one of the channels ran away in such a manner as to worsen the short period pitching oscillation, it would be automatically switched off by the other three on the majority vote system. And so, as I say, hopefully that would be an unknown quantity to the squadron pilot. It also exhibited an ever-increasing nose-down trim change at high Mach number. And again, this was overcome by fitting a Mach trimmer, which applied excessive up elevator with increasing Mach number, such as to provide a self-recovery tendency. And of course the limitations were on the RAF squadron aircraft were such as to hopefully never encounter the very marked nose down trim change.
Did the Delta plan form have a much longer, what they call a mean aerodynamic chord, than a normal aircraft? In other words, the range through which the centre of pressure and centre of gravity moves.
Do you know, I'm not sure of that. I suppose that is probably the case. You see, strangely, I suppose, unlike a lot of aeroplanes, the Vulcan was rather improved by flying at aft CG rather than forward. For example, on the approach to land. I mean, clearly, if you need to increase height during a landing approach, one pulls back on the stick. But if you think about it, that shed lift, because the entire trailing edge was taken up in the Mark II with elevons, and so that shed lift. And so there would be a somewhat of a tendency to drop rather than increase height. At aft CG, of course, there would be less up elevator, and so this effect was minimised. So for preference, one tended to, with distributable fuel between front and rear tanks, it was rather a nicer aeroplane at RCG for the landing than at forward. The other characteristic, which of course was not peculiar to the Vulcan, was buffeting, which reduced the amount of manoeuvrability available at high altitude, and that, I suppose, was where the 707A really came into its own, because the A was used to develop the very sophisticated droop leading edge which led to the full version on the Mark II Vulcan, an interim version on the Mark I with a relatively small change, because by that time there were a lot of production aeroplanes on the line, and it was necessary to introduce a modification which didn't affect aft of the main spar. And so a simplified version of the droop leading edge was incorporated in what became the Mark I Vulcan. Fixed.
And this came in on the crank leading edge.
That's right. That's right.
The earlier
but
one
the earlier.
Didn't have it.
I think the earlier one, yes, did to a small extent, but that beautiful shape on the Mark II was very, very sophisticated. In fact, you mentioned Stuart Davis a while ago. We had tried on the 707 as a means of overcoming this problem of reduced maneuverability due to buffeting. We had tried all the standard fixes of the day, like vortex generators on the wings to suppress the shock stall at the wing tips, which was the primary cause of the buffeting. We had tried fences. We had tried a very primitive droop leading edge. And I well remember attending a meeting by people which included Farnborough and the National Physics Laboratory, and a somewhat diffident gentleman who hadn't made much contribution to the discussion after he had listened to our tests and our experiences and the results, said in a very quiet little voice, "Well, what you really need is something like this." And he then drew a conical camber.
Well, I was going on to ask you about that. But
and we put this on the 707A, and it was an instant success.